So I want you to imagine standing on this dry, just incredibly dusty hillside.
Yeah, and your stomach is completely empty.
Right, totally empty. You're watching the sky and you're praying for rain because, I mean, your very survival depends on it.
Absolutely.
And meanwhile, down in the city, the exact same religious leader who just legally seized your neighbor's farm, he's standing on a street corner, blowing a literal trumpet to announce to the crowd, how much money he's donating to charity.
It's wild. It's just such a stark contrast.
It really is. So today we are taking a deep dive into Matthew chapter 6, but we're not reading it as some stained glass, comfortable Sunday sermon. We are looking at this text as a radical survival guide for a deeply oppressed people.
Yeah, and it completely changes the landscape of the text when you view it through that lens.
Totally.
I mean, we are moving way past the standard theological readings today to uncover the incredibly high-stakes political tension and really the visceral day-to-day drama simmering right beneath the surface of these ancient words.
Now, real quick, because this text obviously sits at the intersection of, deeply held faiths and some very volatile ancient politics, we do need to set some ground rules for today's deep dive.
Right, very important.
We are looking at this strictly as historians and analysts. So we're exploring the sociology, the economic mechanics, and we're looking at the text as an ancient political document.
Exactly. Neither of us is here to take sides or endorse a religious viewpoint or push any kind of theological agenda.
Right. We are just genuinely fascinated by the explosive impact this document had in its own time. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Well, to really grasp the explosion, you have to understand the powder keg.
Yeah, the context is everything.
The original audience listening to these words, in first century Judea, they were living in a brutal reality. They were under the heavy, oppressive boot of Roman imperial rule.
But wait, hold on. When we think of like the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, we usually think of vast trade networks or new roads and aqueduct.
The infrastructure.
Yeah. Wasn't there some level of commerce and infrastructure actually protecting these people from total ruin?
See, that's a common misconception. That infrastructure was largely designed for extraction, not local protection.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, Rome didn't just occupy the land militarily, they strangled it economically.
How so?
Well, they utilized this localized network of corrupt toll and tax collectors. The system was essentially, it was like a franchise model of extortion.
The franchise
Yeah, a
model.
local collector would bid for the right to collect taxes in a certain region. And as long as they sent Rome its required quota, they could keep whatever surplus they squeezed out of the local population.
Jeez. So the incentive structure is literally built on ruthless extortion. The more you crush your neighbor, the richer you get.
Right.
And the goal wasn't just funding the empire. I mean, it sounds like systemic impoverishment. Like it was designed to keep the general population weak, desperate, and basically incapable of funding a rebellion.
Precisely. And we have to look at who that general population actually was. I mean, these were almost entirely subsistence farmers living in the Levant.
Right, which means we aren't talking about massive agricultural conglomerates with, advanced irrigation systems.
No, not at all.
These are families dependent entirely on the early autumn rains to soften the ground for plowing, and then the latter spring rains to swell the grain.
Yeah, it's living season to season.
So if the rain is 2 weeks late, or if one of those corrupt tax collectors decides to seize your seed grain to meet his quota,
You don't just have a bad fiscal quarter.
right, your family starves.
There is zero margin for error, no savings, no safety net. What's fascinating here is how that brutal daily reality changes the very definition of the word anxiety in this
Oh,
text.
that's a really good point.
Because modern readers often treat the anxiety mentioned in Matthew 6 as, a psychological stressor.
Like worrying about a career path or social standing or a mortgage rate.
Exactly. But for the crowd sitting on that hillside, anxiety over food, water, and clothing wasn't some abstract concept.
It was the physical knot in your stomach when the sky stayed blue for way too long.
Yes, it was the terror of watching a Roman patrol walk past your field.
So when Jesus addresses anxiety in this chapter, he isn't offering like a general wellness tip.
No, he is speaking directly into an atmosphere of absolute systemic economic desperation.
Man. But the Roman occupation is really only half the nightmare for this crowd, right?
Unfortunately, yeah.
Because if I'm a starving farmer and an occupying empire is taxing my grain, I'm immediately looking to my local leaders for help.
Naturally.
I'm looking to my community's religious and legal authorities to, protect me. So what were the local elites doing while all of this was happening?
Well, that brings us to the Pharisees and the scribes. the religious establishment of the day. And rather than protecting the vulnerable, they recognized the desperation of the masses, and they capitalized on it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, they weaponized faith to consolidate their own power and wealth.
See, here's where it gets really interesting. The way they did this was through what we would call today performative piety.
Oh, entirely.
They took spiritual disciplines, you know, giving to the poor, praying, fasting, and turned them into high-production political theater.
It was a highly calculated public relations campaign. I mean, when giving charity, they would literally have trumpets blown in the busy streets and synagogues.
Literal trumpets.
Literal trumpets to ensure maximum visibility before handing over the money.
That is just, it's the ancient equivalent of filming yourself handing a $100 bill to a homeless person and instantly posting it online for clout.
That's exactly what it is. And the prayer practices were just as theatrical.
Right.
They weren't just praying quietly in the temple. Yeah. They would purposefully stand at the most crowded intersections in the city to pray out loud.
And they specifically timed their prayers to coincide with the peak pedestrian traffic of the day, right?
Yes. Rush hour prayers.
Yeah.
Add to that the practice of fasting twice a week. But they didn't do it quietly.
Of course not.
They would intentionally disfigure their faces, wear unkempt clothing, and look as miserable as possible.
Just to advertise their extreme holiness and sacrifice to everyone walking by.
Exactly.
Okay, looking at that from the outside, it is incredibly arrogant. Like we said, it's ancient social media posturing. But how does blowing a trumpet or praying loudly on a corner actually hurt anyone?
Right. It seems harmless on the surface.
Yeah. How does that translate into the systemic exploitation we were talking about earlier?
Well, we have to look at the ancient legal and social mechanics. In a society where religion, law, and culture are deeply, deeply intertwined, displaying ultra-piety generates an enormous amount of social capital.
Okay, I'm following.
It creates unquestioned public trust. You convince the desperate masses that you are the true, pure representative of God.
And once you have that absolute trust, what do you do with it?
You leverage it financially.
Wow.
Yeah. The text and historical context indicate that these religious elites used their elevated status to gain access to the estates of the most defenseless members of society.
Which would be who?
Specifically, widows and orphans. Because women in this patriarchal society often couldn't manage inheritances directly, they required legal guardians or trustees.
Oh, let me guess. Who better to trust with your late husband's estate than the incredibly holy man who prays on the street corner every day and fasts twice a week?
That is exactly the logic they relied on.
That is so dark.
It is. Because once appointed as trustees or legal experts managing these estates, they would charge exorbitant administrative fees, mismanage the funds, or purposefully entangle the widows in legal debt.
So essentially, they use the illusion of holiness to legally embezzle and foreclose on the last remaining assets of the vulnerable.
Yes.
So it's a double occupation.
That's a great way to put it.
You have the Roman Empire taxing you to death from the outside with swords, and then the corrupt religious leaders bleeding you dry from the inside with legal loopholes and religious theater.
Yes, and that is the simmering, explosive tension in the crowd listening to the Sermon on the Mount.
Which completely changes how we must view Jesus' teachings in Matthew 6.
Completely.
I mean, these are not gentle spiritual suggestions for a quiet life. This is a targeted systemic takedown of a corrupt power structure.
Exactly. He comes in and starts systematically dismantling their entire racket.
And the strategy is kind of brilliant. He doesn't just yell at the elites. He commands his followers to do the exact opposite of what the elites are doing.
Right.
He says in Matthew 6.1, you know, be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the religious elites relied entirely on having an audience.
They needed the applause.
Yes. Their social control and subsequently their legal ability to drain those widows' estates, it only functioned if the public was watching and applauding their piety.
So by instructing the masses to give anonymously, to pray behind closed doors, and to, like, wash their faces when they fast so no one knows,
Jesus is actively bankrupting the social capital of the elites.
Wow. He's telling the crowd, that guy blowing the trumpet, the applause you're giving him is the only reward he's ever going to get. God isn't listening.
Yes. It bypasses the religious establishment entirely. He is removing them as the necessary middlemen between the people and the divine.
You don't need the corrupt scribe. You can just go into your room and close the door.
Exactly.
And that leads perfectly into the Lord's Prayer, which is planted right in the middle of this chapter, specifically Matthew 6.9 to 10.
Right, the most famous part.
Our Father in heaven, Hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Now, taking into account everything we just discussed about Rome and the local elites, if I'm standing in a territory occupied by the Roman Empire and I publicly pray for a different kingdom to arrive and a different will to be enforced on earth, isn't that bordering on sedition?
Oh, it crosses the border into sedition.
Well,
It is an incredibly radical act of resistance. Mm. You are publicly delegitimizing Caesar's kingdom.
You are praying for the end of the Roman occupation without ever picking up a sword.
Exactly. And you are simultaneously praying for the end of the corrupt religious system that has allied itself with that earthly power to exploit the poor.
Right.
You are invoking a supreme authority structure that completely supersedes both the Roman governor in his palace and the high priest in his temple. This was a quiet revolution.
A quiet revolution. I love that. That perfectly describes the mechanism here. He is stripping the oppressors of their power by changing the minds, the allegiances, and the daily habits of the people they are trying to oppress.
But, you know, dismantling a corrupt power base is really only step one.
Right, because taking down the social clout of a Pharisee doesn't magically make the rain fall.
Exactly.
And it doesn't put bread on the table for a starving family.
Right, so once he undercuts the elites, he immediately shifts his focus back to the victims, those desperate, impoverished farmers. He moves from subverting the powerful to offering a profound, radical framework of comfort for the powerless.
So Jesus starts reframing the very concepts of wealth, security, and anxiety.
Yes. He points out the futility of chasing earthly wealth in Matthew 6.21, saying, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also."
And he is speaking to a crowd that literally has no earthly treasure.
Right. And he is validating their reality by telling them that the very thing the Romans and the Pharisees are obsessively hoarding, you know, gold, estates, political power, is fundamentally hollow and vulnerable to decay.
And then he delivers the absolute hammer blow in Matthew 6.24. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money.
It's powerful.
He draws a completely uncompromising line in the sand.
And you have to view that binary through the context of the first century. The religious elites were actively attempting to serve God while explicitly using that religious service to acquire money and exploit estates.
Right. They thought they were doing both.
Yes.
Yeah.
Jesus is publicly declaring their entire way of life a spiritual and logical impossibility.
But then he turns to the crowd, the people who actually don't have enough money to survive, and he points to the birds of the air and the lilies of the field.
Yeah, the imagery is beautiful.
He points out how God faithfully provides for them, even though they don't toil or spin. And that leads to Matthew 6.33. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well.
Right.
So what does this all mean? If I'm playing devil's advocate here, if I'm that subsistence farmer facing literal starvation because Rome took my grain.
Yeah.
Seek first his kingdom sounds incredibly dismissive. I mean, it almost sounds like a modern politician offering thoughts and prayers to someone who needs a hot meal. How is a desperate person supposed to actually apply that?
I get that. It absolutely sounds dismissive to modern ears if we strip away the historical context.
Yeah.
But we have to remember the systems at play here.
Okay.
This wasn't a dismissal of their suffering. It was a radical alternative to the oppressive systems that were actively causing their suffering.
Walk me through that. Like, how does seeking the kingdom feed them?
Well, think about what trusting the current worldly systems required. If you placed your trust in the Roman economy, you were crushed by predatory taxes.
Yeah.
If you placed your trust in the local religious structure, you were legally exploited by the Pharisees. Both of those systems demanded your absolute allegiance to a ruthless financial extraction machine.
They were rigged games. Like, there was literally no way for the farmer to win.
Exactly. So Jesus is presenting a counter-narrative.
Mm-hmm.
He is introducing them to a heavenly father whose nature is entirely fundamentally different from the nature of Caesar or the scribes.
Right.
Trusting this heavenly father to provide was an active act of defiance against the systems of the day.
It's basically refusing to play their money-driven game altogether.
Right. Seeking the kingdom first meant aligning your life with this new quiet revolution. It meant practicing secret generosity in your community, engaging in genuine, quiet prayer, and trusting in divine provision.
Instead of participating in the anxiety-inducing, cutthroat rat race created by their oppressors.
Exactly. It was about building an alternate community economy based on mutual care and divine trust, completely outside the control of Rome and the temple elites.
That is a complete rewiring of their worldview.
It really is.
He's essentially telling them that the people with all the money, the trumpets, and the political power are actually the ones who are spiritually bankrupt and terrified.
Yes.
And the people sitting in the dirt who have nothing but who trust in this alternative kingdom are the ones who are actually secure.
And that reframing is where the profound comfort finally lands. I mean, it doesn't instantly fill their stomachs that afternoon, but it completely restores their human dignity.
Wow.
It assures them that they are seen by the divine not as taxable assets for an empire and not as gullible marks for a corrupt priesthood, but as inherently valued beings who are worth far more than the birds of the air.
That is incredibly powerful when you realize the psychological weight of the Roman boot that was on their necks. It makes these verses so much more than just, you know, pretty poetry to cross stitch on a pillow. It is literally a survival guide for the oppressed, designed to strip power from the corrupt and give dignity back to the broken.
Very well said.
Well, as we wrap up today's deep dive, I want to leave you, our listener, with a final provocative thought to really mull over, a thought that builds on this whole historical powder keg we've been exploring today.
Well, this is a good one.
Yeah. We spent a lot of time talking about how these words comforted the poor farmers.
Hmm.
But I want you to picture the actual scene on that hillside one more time. Jesus is speaking these words publicly, which means the elites, the scribes, and the Pharisees were almost certainly standing right there in the crowd, listening.
Right, they were definitely there.
I want you to ponder how that strict, unyielding warning, "You cannot serve both God and money," must have sounded to the corrupt religious leaders standing maybe 50 feet away.
The tension would have been unreal.
The very men who were, at that exact moment in history, explicitly stealing the estates of widows while wearing their holy robes. This wasn't just general spiritual advice for future generations. This was a devastating, point-blank economic critique leveled directly at the oppressors standing right in front of him.
Yeah, imagine the absolute tension in the air at that moment. The silence must have been deafening.
Now, I want to turn this conversation over to you. I want you to drop a comment below right now and tell us your thoughts on today's historical drama.
Yeah, we really want to hear from you.
Seriously, scroll down and let us know. Which part of the political tension in this first century tinderbox surprised you the most today? Was it the predatory legal theater of the religious elites foreclosing on widows? Or was it the subtle, quiet treason of the Lord's Prayer against the Roman Empire? I really want to read what you think about this.
It's such a rich topic. There's so much to unpack.
There really is. And hey, if you enjoyed this deep dive into the hidden history and the mechanics behind the text, please make sure to hit that like button.
It really helps us out a ton.
It does. And hit subscribe to the channel so you never miss out on our future explorations. Also, before you go, explicitly remind yourself to check the description below.
Oh, yeah. Lots of good stuff down there.
We have put together some exclusive links and resources just for you to explore this topic further, and you are definitely going to want to check those out.
Definitely.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today and for exploring the fascinating, messy reality of history with us.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Get ready, because our next deep dive is going to be even more intense. See you then.